Yeah, well, and then we'll just...
We'll just have fun doing it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you want to have fun, we could have fun. Welcome to the Orangutan Podcast. I am your host, Anthony Porter.
I'm Gary Shapiro.
Journey under the canopy with us and through the woods as we discover the rainforest and its conservation. Welcome, folks, to the Orangutan Podcast. I am your host, Anthony Porter, and with me we have Gary Shapiro. Let me do your intro real quick because it's extensive and I'm proud that I wrote it. Dr. Gary Shapiro, lifelong orangutan conservationist and biologist, founder of the Orangutan Republic Foundation, author of his rainforest conservation memoirs called Out of the Cage, and a very good friend.
Oh, thank you.
Sweet. Well, wonderful, Gary. I mean, so this is episode, I think, 6 now, and we have done 6 episodes in the last 3 years. So it's kind of fun because we have plenty to talk about in terms of like catching up with our adventures. So yeah. You've been to Indonesia in the last what?
Couple of months. Yeah. Man. I was there on a extended expedition on a cruise ship and we stopped along the way in Borneo.
You're being modest. So you taught on the cruise ship, right?
I lectured about orangutans and biodiversity so and things cool. like that. It was a fun experience on coral expeditions. Give it a plug, you know, if anybody wants to go on one of their wonderful expeditions, they should check it out online.
Heck yeah.
And it's out of Australia, but it was a 30-day experience for myself and my wife, who was teaching yoga therapy and was the wellness coach on board. So we had a ball. It was a great time. We got to meet a lot of wonderful people, mostly Australians.
Nice.
But this was my chance to come back after all those years, you know, after, you know, 26 years, being able to go back and see some of the individuals there. And, of course, many have moved on. New ones came in. And then later on, we went to Tanjung Puting, where, of course, I spent my time visiting the various orangutan viewing areas at Camp Leakey and Pondek Tenggui, and you've been there, so you had a chance to see them.
Yeah, that was amazing. Yeah.
So those were the two major orangutan experiences that we had there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Nice. And when the people come onto the ship, are they knowledgeable of the orangutan stuff, or are you the introduction for them to learn more about it?
I think for the most part, I'm their introductory to it because these are people who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. Yeah. We even have people in their 90s. And so they're doing their bucket list tours, you know, and they're traveling and seeing the, you know, nature close up. So it's an eco tour type of experience with, you know, people numbering from, in our case, 40 people on that expedition to Borneo. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of interaction. They had, of course, they were taken well care of. We want to make sure that when you're that age, you're not gonna be doing crazy things. But some of these people are in great shape, you know. And we went to other parts of Indonesia, and they're climbing mountains and having a blast. So, it was a great experience for us.
I feel like when I went there, I lost like 5 years of my. I mean, like I got younger. Like just getting there in that like super replenishing atmosphere, I was like, oh, great, because I live at like 7,000 feet and going down to literal like super tropical climate, zero like elevation, it's really I don't know.
You have the oxygen and it's being pumped into your lungs, so you have all this extra energy.
Yeah. You know what I didn't expect was when I got onto one of the ships to go upstream or go upriver, the swiftlet buildings that are extremely loud.
Swallows and swifts. So,
swallows and swifts.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so I got there. I got to this dock, and then these giant, giant buildings. Nothing was really built over like 20 feet except for these huge concrete cubes.
Yeah.
And their job is to basically attract a bunch of birds.
The birds for bird nest soup. This is one of the biggest exports from Borneo now that goes off, even to downtown L.A. If you go into some of the Asian marketplaces, you'll see bird nests from Borneo.
Have you eaten bird nest soup?
I've had it. It's actually the saliva of these swifts and swallows.
Uh-huh.
They call it burung walet. And so this has become a big industry. I knew about this years and years ago, but it just started blossoming in Borneo.
Wow.
And wherever you go, especially in central Kalimantan or central Borneo, and even even to West Borneo, to a little bit, you'll find these condominiums for the birds. And what they'll do is they'll play the sounds of the birds to attract them, and they go inside, of course, every once in a while, and they have to harvest them after the birds fledge and leave, and then they'll wash them and they'll dry them and they'll ship them out for export.
I pride myself on being like culturally rounded when I go to other countries. That was the one time I've had severe culture shock, because I got, after being 5 days in the rainforest, I came back to like the city, and the swiftlet buildings were blaring. I mean, it's like on like loud horns, blaring the sound. And then at the same time, the local mosque was right next door and it was blaring their prayers constantly. And like everyone was running around and they wanted to take like photos with me because I was just some white guy. And I was like, this is... Like I usually don't feel that sense of like, oh my God, where am I? But that was like a huge, like that's going to be in my brain forever.
It was for me when I first went out there too in 1978. There were virtually no other Westerners out there, and I was the subject of a lot of attention of the kids on the street and people wherever I went. And again, the culture shock, I had it as well. So it's not unexpected. But as, of course, the world gets smaller and smaller, we get to understand other cultures, you know, through the media. But when you're there and you're, like, absorbed in it and it surrounds you and it kind of infuses you, it's a different kind of a sensorial experience.
Yeah. I mean, we take advantage of the fact that we can just walk down the street here. And, like, there I was walking down the street and there's not a person that wasn't looking at me. Just, you know, and... I mean, part of me is like, but also part of me is like, this is new, you know, to be such an outlier.
Exactly.
It's really fascinating.
Sure. And so you had a wonderful experience yourself.
Yeah. So Gary introduced me to this this tourism company that was super awesome. And they took me up river 4 days in this boat. Awesome. It was me and my best friend, Kurt. And we're just like two college buddies that have just like tried to travel together. And these boats are definitely made for like husband and wife. And so like we shared a bed and like they gave us all this food, and he's vegan. And so they made him vegan food, but they also already bought food for two people if he wasn't vegan. So I was given the food of two people. And I've never been fed better than on that little boat. I mean, but going around was amazing. I mean, we would find like, we stopped for like 10 minutes at this one spot while it was raining. And when I walked back into the boat, they're like, sorry, can you go back outside the boat again? He's like, what happened? I'm like, I think there's a monkey in the engine room. I'm like, oh, cool. We go down there and it's not a monkey. It's like a 7-foot reticulating python.
Oh.
Yeah. And I had photos of it. After like everyone kind of calmed down, they're like, oh, it's not venomous. Reticulating python fangs are just, they go backwards and they don't have those huge fangs in the front. And so I was like, oh, that's fine. And the ranger came down and grabbed it by the head and was holding it and showing it to me. And he gave it to me and I was playing with him and stuff. And it's just the connection between man and nature there is just so fluid because it's so in your face constantly.
Yeah.
Have you experienced something like that?
Well, being surprised by orangutans coming on board, you know, that happened when I was, you know, working on boats years and years ago, wanting to help out or observe me or take something out of the bottom of the boat. And they feel like it's in their, territory.
Yeah.
Unless we work hard to exclude them, they feel like it's theirs to use.
Yeah, sure. It's their, it's their rainforest. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I had those experiences too. Sure.
Awesome.
Sure.
Yeah. So, I want to get a little bit into fun facts from the audience. So, I asked a few of you folks, what's your favorite thing about the rainforest? And I don't think you expected me to actually read it on a podcast because I got 19 comments saying, my favorite thing about the rainforest, wet. Just the word wet. Another one is, fun fact is, it doesn't actually rain forests. Then there's a lot of other ones talking about the biodiversity. And then a lot of people took it seriously, which is really beautiful. I think my favorite one is the fun fact is that it doesn't actually rain forests. I love it. The interesting thing that I saw in the rainforest was the amount of macaques. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot of different primates that live in the rainforest, and there was like an overabundance of macaques specifically. Do you know like why that population would be higher than, let's say, like, I don't know, a gibbon or something else that you might find out there?
Well, what you were seeing were the Macaca fascicularis. That's the species of long-tailed macaques, and they are cosmopolitan in Southeast Asia. So they breed very well. They're not like endangered in any great way. Some populations are actually, but for the species as a whole, there's probably, you know, very robust populations scattered around. They've been used for biomedical research, which from an ethical standpoint, you know, kind of rubs me the wrong way. But, and I know that there are a lot of people who are very, you know, monkey centric. They really want to make sure these monkeys are cared for. There could be areas where there's like an overabundance, but frankly, they do come down to the river, just like the proboscis monkeys, and this is where they spend the night. And so if you see them, what you're doing is you're getting a sample error of their distribution, because they're all coming down to the river in the morning or in the evening. You'll find them there.
Yeah.
Then they scatter and they go off into the forest foraging for food.
Okay. My empirical observations are flawed based off of my sample size.
Exactly. Yep. And this is what humans do constantly.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I saw something funny. Somebody on social media was going, hey, I've been around the entire globe. There is not 8 billion people here. He's like, I have seen a max of a few million people. I would say maybe top is 100 million.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, so you haven't seen every human being, so you are not saying that there's 8 billion people? It's just very funny. That's kind of, I mean, that's the value of empiricism being checked by other things.
And we have this bias, right? We have biases on everything.
Yeah.
We're not neutral. We're not like silicon chips that just look and come with the data. We have our pre-existing beliefs, and we look for data that match those beliefs.
Yeah.
So if, you know, somebody doesn't see all the people in the world, it's like, well, I don't see that also, that the world is round. It looks flat to me. And there are a lot of flat earthers out there because
there's honestly more and more, because social media gives them the voice to talk more.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But again, when you start to look at the bigger picture, if you look at the universe, you look at all, there's a lot out there we just don't see unless we have this, like the telescopes that are now telling us, you know, there are more stars in the universe then there are, of course, grains of sand multiplied by 9,000, each grain of sand. There's like a tremendous number of stars out there. We don't see them. We see the stars in the sky that we can, you know, that our eyes detect. But the satellites looking at the edge of the universe, going back into time, see far more galaxies. And each galaxy, you know, there's trillions of galaxies and there are trillions of stars. You multiply those numbers, you get an enormous number. But people can't wrap their minds around that.
Yeah, yeah. There's I actually talked with a bit of a flat earther the other day, and she was saying that she's like, why is the moon always facing us? We orbit around the sun, but the moon never orbits around us. Why is that? There's something off. I'm like, do you want me to look it up, or are you gonna actually believe if I find the answer? And she's like, no, I'm not gonna believe you. It's the internet. I'm like, oh my gosh. Anyways, I looked it up. And yeah, it's called tidal or lunar fixing, to where when an object is close enough to another sphere, then the face fixes to one side. But we're not close enough to the sun for that to happen. Hence, we have beautiful one day rotations. Mm-hmm. And I told her that, and she goes, "I don't think so."
Well, a lot of people aren't prepared to accept that, you know. And again, if they have a belief, when they have some data that conflicts with that belief, there is this dissonance in their head, and they'd rather kind of not deal with that, because that would cause them to have to change what they believed all their lives.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of that, I mean, going back to the rainforest, I mean, I definitely saw, I mean, the guide, his parents that took me around the rainforest, he was super knowledgeable in all this naturalism stuff. His parents completely converted their local farm to palm oil and burned it to palm oil.
Yep.
And he didn't really see that much of a problem with palm oil being like the factor for deforestation. And so how do you get like a myopic, I mean, you've been educating like on the ship, how do you get that myopic viewpoint of like, this is just my world and this is how the world is, and then give that like objective, have you had a I don't know, what's the word? Have you had success showing people a bigger picture?
I think so. I think people who are educated, who feel that, you know, that there's a lot more out there in this world than just what is in their perceptual fields, are probably more open to receiving more information. Mm. You know, and again, you know, if you're in these people taking cruises, They're wealthier than probably most. Most of them have some higher degree of education. And when you talk with them, you get an idea of where they lie on that spectrum. So I think for the most part, when I gave my presentations about estate plantations and talked about its threat, yeah, they were receptive. And again, I don't just paint a single, you know, brushstroke picture on it. It's complex. And again, when you start talking complexity, this is where people kind of like their eyes glaze over. Mm-hmm. Because then now you're forced to look at things instead of just a simplistic black-white situation. Now you're in shades of gray. And we talk about, say, smallholders, like your friend that you were visiting, you know, and he was telling you about changing his farm from maybe some crops to palm oil. For a smallholder that's only got a couple of hectares, that's quite different from a corporation that is converting tens of thousands of hectares into a big plantation, a monoculture plantation.
Yeah.
So you've got to kind of understand that. And we don't want to vilify farmers who are trying to make ends meet, mm-hmm, right? And millions of farmers in Indonesia depend on palm oil to pay the bills.
So we're promoting local smaller scale farms instead of vast swaths of...
No, we're not promoting it.
Okay.
We're not vilifying them for
not
doing
vilifying
it. We would like to give them maybe an option of doing polyculture instead of monoculture.
Okay.
In other words, have fallback crops. Because if, you know, the price of palm oil drops and now it's more expensive to produce it than what they're getting, they're going to be in debt.
Yeah, whole island is going to be under, yeah.
Exactly. But if you have some other crops like cassava, you know, of course, that's grown in Borneo all the time, but you have other things, other crops that they could grow, whether it's, you know, corn or whatever, then they'll have something to at least eat, because you can't just eat palm oil kernels. That's not, it ain't going to work.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to balance that portfolio out for your family to survive during, you know, lean times, if you know what I mean.
It's almost like biodiversity,
yeah,
is beneficial.
Exactly.
Look at that. Yeah. It's funny. I was walking. There's a abandoned gold mine that a local nonprofit took over, and they're reforesting there.
Okay.
It was really awesome. So we took our boat to go down there, and it was really cute. There was like a bunch of like resident cats that were hanging out in the area, and we went out and planted a bunch of trees. And I've been taking Filipino martial arts classes here in Lake Tahoe. Not up here. I'm far away. And we have these rotan sticks that we use, yeah, in order to fight with. And I didn't know. Someone's like, oh, yeah, that's a rotan tree over there.
Right.
Like, what? That's rotan? And it's just insanely, like, spiky, aggressive-looking plant.
Yes.
That people, like, can fashion into really resilient fighting material. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's such a full circle moment. It's on the other side of the planet.
Yeah. And I've been cut up by rotan going through the forests, you know, in my early days. So they're I
huge.
Know about that. Yeah. But, you know,
all
they do is it's a big export out of Kumai. Mm. And I remember when I first got out there, I saw shiploads of the stuff coming out. And it can be done. It can be harvested sustainably. So those are the kinds of products, you know, non-timber forest products,
yeah,
that can be harvested and provide an income source for the local people. And, you know, if we can do that sustainably, that's really part of the key of keeping these forests intact.
I love it. Yeah, absolutely. All right, I want to get in some of these topics right here. We've got some trivia questions. We're going to see if you can answer it. I'm pretty sure you can, because you're you. And then we're going to see if we can expand on it and just talk more about it. So,
sure.
This is going to be specific, but you don't need to give me the full taxonomic name. Which physiological marker in orangutans have been correlated with stress in fragmented or human-impacted environments? Physiological marker.
You want me to answer that question?
Yeah, if you know.
Well, I think cortisol is probably one of the markers that of stress hormone. And it's been researched, of course, in not just orangutans, but other primates, where dominance hierarchies will show that, you know, if you're the dominant male, you probably have a reduced cortisol because, you know, you're dominant. But it's the ones that are trying to vie for that dominant position. They're the ones who have the increased stress hormones building up.
I can't stump you. That's, yes.
Well,
okay,
I mean,
well,
look,
cool. That's good. I will add that one part of this says that it is mainly found from scientists and elevated fecal matter So that's how they would go around and collect to see what kind of cortisol levels they had.
And urine. They actually collect urine. We have researchers doing that. Feces is a little bit easier to collect.
I was going to say, you're going to hold a bowl behind?
Like, yeah, or you... they hold plastic sheets.
Oh.
Or they have little nets or, I guess, funnels, large ones on sticks that they try to
I was totally
wait.
Joking, but that's actually how you do it.
Yeah, yeah, you wait in the morning. You know, the first thing they do is they kind of hang over the edge of the nest and they do their business and you try to collect it as fresh as you can. And then hopefully, if you don't do the tests in field with like test kits, little strips, or, you know, doing some basic measurements, you try to freeze it. You put it on ice and you send it out to the lab to look for these, because these will break down with
yeah.
the heat.
Wow. Okay. Well, cool. I mean, scientists are awesome, and you never have to really think about how they get their data sometimes. But
yeah, I just love that it's still going on. We still need new scientists going out there. This is the big challenge. So how do we enroll young people to go into science and go into, say, you know, biology and maybe yeah. specialize in primatology and then look into, say, the physiology issues that are kind of tied with the animals and their environment and their social milieu, because all of this conspires to cause, you know, these amazing changes in their physiology.
Yeah.
And then the markers, we can find those. So we have that going on in West Borneo and in Central Borneo. I'm just always thrilled to see that people, young people, are going out there and helping out on projects like this.
Man.
To try to gather this data, because it takes time to tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's the need for scientists directly correlates with the societal encouragement of that thing. And so,
yeah.
I mean, for me personally, I mean, I would think that make it more profitable to be a scientist, and then I think it would be more socially accepted. I mean, and that's really what the Rain Center Republic does, is you fund the education to get these
yeah.
folks out there. I mean, that's a full circle moment again.
It is. It's bearing fruit. You know, and I'm so proud that now this is our 20th anniversary this year of something that started with a single scholarship in 2006. And
wow.
now we're giving out our 20th year of now 30 new scholarships each year for the five provinces that wild orangutans are in Indonesia. So we're planting seeds, we're continuing to manage that, we're seeing the fruits of the harvest, you know, and these students, like 41 of them now, of the 204 graduates, five graduates as I speak, are working for nonprofits that are dealing in the field or helping with conservation.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I think, such a good investment in the future. And I have great hopes that this will actually serve as a model for other species in other parts of the world.
I love it. And folks, all that's funded by you. I mean, if you're at home and you're like, how do I give back? I mean, this is a direct correlation with all the stuff that you just heard about. I mean, this is how it gets done.
We have the sponsor a student scholarship for anybody that wants to support this program. And you get certificates, you get pictures, you get to follow the students as they matriculate. And, you know, you might even, if you're willing to come out maybe on a ceremony, we can arrange that to witness the honoring of new students, too.
I want to come. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. Cool, folks. All right, we're going to split this episode up into two places. So this is episode 6. We're finishing off here, and then we're going to come back for episode 7 in a few minutes. Well, I guess you're going to see it in like a week after, but just look at the next episode. You guys rock. Thank you.